Hello. Would you please
Hello.
start by stating your name, the date, the time, and your location?
Sure, my name is Marquise Allen. The date is May 23rd, 2022. The time is 5:04 p.m. Central Time, and I'm located in Tennessee, the United States.
And do you consent to having this interview recorded, digitally uploaded, and publicly released under a Creative Commons license, attribution, non-commercial share alike?
Yes, I do.
Thank you so much. I'd like to just start by asking you to introduce yourself to anyone who might find themselves listening to this. What would you want them to know about you and the place you're speaking from?
Sure. I'm a certified end-of-life doula, and I have been trained both within the United States and within the United Kingdom. I'm a member of several end-of-life doula associations, and I really believe in what I do, and I believe in trying to support others to the best of my ability. And what really brought me into this field actually was the passing of my grandfather. And I actually did not have time to grieve. And so, after doing research, I found that there was a such thing as an end-of-life doula, and that's really what got me on my way. So, I founded Serene Transitions, End-of-Life Doula Services, LLC. I founded that after going through some motions when it came to grieving with my grandfather, and then I really just took off running. So, that's just a little bit about me. Yeah.
May I ask how old you were when your grandfather died?
I was, oh gosh, I was around my early 30s. And so I was around in my early 30s.
Would you tell me a story about life during the pandemic?
Wow, life during the pandemic. Life during the pandemic has been, it has been eye-opening. It has allowed me to, for me personally, it has really, to some extent, been a godsend because although my profession does require me to interact with people, I am more of an introverted person. So working remotely, doing things without face-to-face, person-to-person, in-person interaction, that I have no objections to that. So really when it happened, it was like, okay, wow, everyone is kind of adopting a new normal. And what was not really considered normal at that time, that is meeting virtually, doing a lot of things remotely and virtually, it really forced people's hand to have to do things virtually, to have to work virtually, to have to collaborate virtually, to have to interface virtually, to have to leverage the use of technology. And so I think personally it maybe accelerated that usage. But going all the way around the world to answer your question, a story that occurred during this pandemic actually is, while I don't talk about it in my doula profession, so to speak, I'm a spiritual person, I'm a religious person, and so it was interesting with my church. We actually were going face to face, and then all of a sudden we had to go virtual because of the pandemic. And so there were a lot of growing pains, a lot of people cut their teeth on it, but it has been really, again, a godsend, so to speak, because it allows us, even when we may have activities or an event planned, we're able to use technology. And so I think people really appreciate that. Some people do, some people don't, but being able to jump on the technology and use it, I think that that was not a thought. It wasn't even a thought pre-pandemic, but it has been now. And I think a lot of people are a lot more comfortable now being able to switch between the two. So That's something that did happen in my own day-to-day living, if you will, in the pandemic.
What did it feel like to have that move from face-to-face to online in a religious community?
In a religious community, in a religious setting, it was, it felt different. It's the equivalent, I would say, if you cross your arms, if you fold your arms right now, you fold them a certain way. However, if you take time and you try to fold them the opposite, for example, if you cross your right arm over your left naturally without thinking about it, you have to think about crossing your left arm over your right, and it doesn't hurt. You're doing the same thing, but you're just doing it a little differently. So that was the experience. That's how it felt for me. Now, at the same time, that's how it was in the beginning. But even though I'm used to using technology in a religious environment, it was really different because trying to facilitate, trying to get the same experience, you can't really get that same worship type experience in a virtual environment. You can come close to it, but you really can't duplicate it exactly or replicate it exactly. While I liked it because sometimes you can cut off your camera and you can do other things while listening to a message or listening to songs and you can get things done. At the same time, it did take away from the in-person feeling. However, I'm a little partial to it. Even now, if I have a lot going on, I want to jump in there, but because I'm a member of the staff, and other people may not want to do that. It can be challenging because of the fact that there are people that want to be face to face, and that is their, modus operandi, and they will go to any limits to ensure that happens. So sometimes it can cause conflict on a personal level because you have some people that want to remain face to face. You have others that want to go virtual. So you have that element. You have different generations. The younger generation, they're more adept and they're more inclined, and they will lend themselves to doing things virtually, whereas maybe a older generation may not be so inclined, but if they wanted to take part, then they really were forced to due to the pandemic. So again, it was a little stressful. It felt stressful. It felt good. A range of different emotions that took place when that happened.
I'd love to hear more about your relationship to spirituality.
Well, my relationship with spirituality is I'm a very open-minded individual. And while that, let's say, that necessarily doesn't always lend itself in a positive environment in the traditional religious atmosphere, I try to keep an open mind. And I know what I was taught, and I know where my personal beliefs are, yet I have friends that are Muslims, I have friends that are Jewish, so I'm aware of some of those traditions, and I embrace them because I love them as brothers and sisters. And so, again, I literally have been around the world in Dubai. I went to a mosque, and I worship there with my Islamic brothers and sisters, my Muslim brothers and sisters. In Rome, I went to Catholic Mass being in Rome, and I partook of Catholic Mass, even though I didn't speak Italian, and I don't. Being there in that atmosphere, it was calming. It was peaceful. And again, people of different religions, been to bar mitzvahs, things of that nature. So again, while I personally have my own personal beliefs, I'm very open-minded, and I really appreciate other points of views, other religions, other thinking patterns, other beliefs. So I personally am extremely open-minded and considerate of the religions and spiritualities and cultures of others.
To the extent that you're comfortable sharing, would you say something about your relationship to health and healthcare infrastructure prior to the pandemic?
Health and healthcare infrastructure, I believe that, prior to the pandemic, health and healthcare, really, I think it needs a major overhaul. I'm not a politician, nor do I aspire to be one. However, it seems like politicians, they seem to be a jack of all trades and masters of none. And even those that do have, for example, medical background occupations, they're still politicians. And I've always been cautiously optimistic that healthcare in this country was meant for the benefit of people. And I say that because many times I believe personally that the healthcare industry, as a lot of other industries do, they put profits before people. And I think that's what tends to happen in a capitalistic society. But at the end of the day, maximizing profit in economics 101, that's the purpose of a business. Regardless of what healthcare industries say, the healthcare industry says they're a business, and what they do is a business, and that business is to make money. You don't go into business to lose money, regardless of what slogans are touted or what marketing campaign is put on. At the end of the day, it's about profits and the bottom line. So I think prior to the pandemic, I believe that there was a disparity in healthcare, especially for people that people, the haves and the haves not, people that have money, people that have insurance, and people that don't. Just in my own personal family alone, there were two family members who ended up passing away. They did not have the best of health insurance, and they did not receive the best health care. And I think that's really unfortunate. It's become a political lightning rod and political talking points for politicians. But also, I do believe that race plays a factor. Being a minority myself, I don't purport to know everything, and I most certainly don't speak for all minorities, but some of the stories that the real life stories that people who are minorities, in particular people of color, that they experience when it comes to healthcare pre-pandemic was already unfortunate. But now post-pandemic, I think that what I just said has been exacerbated. And at the end of the day, there's lots of incentive for people to do things right or wrong to maximize profit and to make money. And when we look at things, for example, such as the pharmaceutical industry or healthcare industry, again, money is the motive. When we hear things on the television and we say, it's said that, you get a free vaccine, I don't think free is the appropriate word. While there may be no out-of-cost expenses, free does not equate to out-of-cost, no out-of-pocket expense does not equate to free. But again, people hear certain words and they attribute certain meanings to them. So, I get a free shot or a free vaccine. Well, they'll know there's just no out-of-pocket cost for you. However, there is a cost, and the pharmaceutical industries, medical device industries, things like that. I think it's, at the end of the day, there's money to be made. And so, of course, if you can offer something and have it be reimbursed at the expense of Jane or John Doe taxpayer, then again, I think that we see more of that happening, even post-pandemic, people getting grants and things like that. But there's an incentive, I think, post-pandemic for people to, let's say, behave badly, if you will. And that's not to be interpreted as a hasty generalization that all people operate badly. I'm not saying that or all companies do. However, I think that just in general, healthcare in this country, post-pandemic, the optics on it haven't shown in the best light, And that doesn't look good to the average person, or they may not know what to look for. But again, looking at some of the details, and well, not details, but looking just at how healthcare or the healthcare industry operates, even post-pandemic, I hesitate to say that everyone's operating with clean hands. So hopefully those disparities decrease between the haves and the have-nots. Hopefully the disparities decrease between the access to healthcare, the cost of healthcare. Hopefully things can, or politicians or people can do things that can hopefully lessen the gap or lessen the divide between haves, the have-not, those that can and cannot. And hopefully, eventually, there can be equality and equity for all persons, irregardless of social status, insurance status, race, gender, sexual orientation, things of that nature. So hopefully, maybe one day, ideally, I might not be here when it happens, but everyone can be treated equally and have a fair shake when it comes to the healthcare industry.
In the pre-pandemic world, what was your day-to-day looking like?
Was my day-to-day living, or what was my day-to-day? I'm sorry.
What was your day-to-day looking like? So living, work, how are you spending your time?
Oh. It started out, again, mostly a lot of face-to-face interaction. A lot of face-to-face interaction and a lot of, just in person, everything. It was quote unquote normal life. And waking up, having some tea, getting to work, checking emails and making contacts and interacting with people, primarily face to face, especially seeing people. Getting up, driving, and meeting clients, as well as being there with them and interfacing with them face-to-face, personally. Traveling, doing some traveling both personally and professionally. Just going to the gym, trying to stay healthy, going to the doctor, going to the dentist. Cooking, just normal everyday stuff. I mean, just normal everyday stuff. Spending time with family. That's pretty much it.
Do you remember when you first heard about the pandemic?
Yes, I do. I first heard about the pandemic. There was talk of this COVID, and it was on the news. I watched the news a lot, and there was just talk of something from China. And it's just, okay, something from China, and didn't know what it was. And it was, I think COVID-19 and coronavirus, I think people use those words interchangeably, even though they're not the same. So we heard about coronavirus, we heard about COVID-19, and there was no real understanding of what it was. And me personally, I wasn't too worried about it. I guess being in the end-of-life doula occupation, and most people should know, and this is not, let me be very clear, what I'm about to say is not to take away from anyone's loss, pain, or hurt. Please, let me very clearly, this is not intended to take away from that. And hopefully, if a snippet is played, this is not to sound insensitive or anything of that nature. However, I do realize that, and we see on the news every day, that people transition, be it from car accidents or from disease or from a wide range of reasons people transition. And so looking, we saw on the TV, we see numbers, we see graphs, we see bar graphs, we see pie charts, we see, and I think at that time there was a political campaign going on, I know here in the United States, and there were politics involved. So of course there was even more, quote unquote hype, if you will, to weaponize the pandemic. So I think there was a lot of information out there. I think there was a lot of misinformation out there. And I'm just looking, trying to keep things objectively, seeing graphs and seeing, oh, millions and thousands and hundreds of thousands and tens of thousands. And so I just was like, okay, well, we'll see what happens. And so things started to become more and more. There was more and more, it seemed like more and more things, the media in particular, more and more information out there. Oh, it's dangerous. It's this, it's that. And I just personally was like, well, what is really going on? Does anyone know what's going on? And at that point in time, again, like I said, there was a political election going on. So of course, there may have been some political interference, if you will, or engagement. So the messaging was just a bit confusing. And I think people became confused, and people didn't know what to believe. There was lots of speculation. There was lots of confusion, lots of misinformation. And I think people were just confused. And I think that, I don't know if you'll ask about it, but I think that may contribute to maybe some of the fatigue that people are experiencing now, because you say this today, you say that tomorrow. It's like, you know, today they say coffee is good for you. Tomorrow they say coffee is bad for you. Today you're supposed to quarantine for 10 days, and then tomorrow it's 5 days. And, you know, you see some of the pushback from some of the, again, corporations out there. Well, you know, corporations writing, well, we need this lifted, or we need this done, or it's not this or that. And, you know, I'm like, well, I okay, you know, people exerting influence over over different types of people exerting influence, people and corporations exerting influence, because I believe that that the pandemic was getting in the way of business. That's just the way it was. And so you start to see some of the interference from industries and companies, corporations, and now all of a sudden they're coming out with statements and their own experts. And it's like, wait a minute, you know? And so it just became a bit overwhelming. People were afraid to, I personally was afraid to cough, or I have allergies. And, you know, if something tickled my nose or if something caused me to sneeze, I was terrified of sneezing because of the reaction that one might receive, that I might receive from society. Oh my goodness, you know, now all of a sudden you're, to some extent, public enemy number one. And, you know, just terrified to sneeze, terrified to cough, and people are looking over their shoulders and people are afraid of you. And it's like, you know, pre-pandemic, it's like, okay, people would sneeze and okay, no big deal. But all of a sudden there were outages. Shelves were going empty. You couldn't find bleach. You couldn't find, and I'm thinking to myself, were people cleaning before the pandemic? Because I know I kept bleach in my house, but it's like, you know, my goodness, were people cleaning? You know, it makes you think, what were people doing before the pandemic? So again, things just became, just hearing about it was just like, what is this? And if it's something we've never heard before and something we've never seen before, like, my goodness, what's going on? You know, so who knows what it really is if it hasn't been here before. But there was just lots of confusion, lots of competing messages. And so, just lots of competing messages and lots of messaging out there. So just a bit of confusion.
Did you have any strategies for moments where you may have needed to cough in shared space with another person?
I guess there were. there were, and I would promptly excuse myself, or I would do my hardest to just not do it. It's just like, if I had to cough, if I had flatulence, I just tried not to make any noise, period, unless I'm talking, because it was just really uncomfortable. And so it just was extremely uncomfortable. So yes, there were incidences, but I tried my hardest not to.
Have you had any of your own experiences of what's sometimes called pandemic fatigue?
Yes, I have. I am at that point now. I am there. I suffer from severe pandemic fatigue. So I have told people, don't talk to me about it. I don't want to hear about it. I don't want, you know, a colleague of mine who I'm very close with, you know, it controlled her life. And she was in a state of literal emergency. And she was the most cautious and preventative and just really cautious and with everything. She was very hyper sensitive to the fact that there's a pandemic, and I would talk to her almost every day, and it was like, wow, you know, okay, you know, we're here, we're in it, we're dealing with it. And you know, this was, and this has been over the course of maybe about a year after the pandemic started. So you know, and it started to cause me anxiety, and it's like, oh my goodness. But at this point in time, I really, you know, I don't want to hear about it. I don't want to hear about the vaccine. I don't want to hear about any of the industries that deal with it. I don't want to hear about COVID. I don't want to hear about, you know, COVID-19. I don't want to hear about coronavirus. And, you know, I certainly am mindful of those. And this is not to be dismissive or insensitive to those people that have suffered at the hands of coronavirus, and were victims of COVID-19. That most certainly is not the case. But as an individual, I wish not to talk about it. I wish not to hear it. It's kind of like a person's sex life. You know, that's your business. And what you do and how you take precautions, that's your business. It's not my business. So as far as I'm concerned, I take the appropriate precautions. I will not say anything to you or anyone else about if they wear a face covering, again, or mask, play on words. People don't like the word mask. I believe a euphemism is face covering. But, you know, I'm not going to say anything to you about that. If you wear it, you wear it. You don't, you don't. If you've been vaccinated, if you've had your shots, you've had them. If you haven't, okay. That's none of my business. You know, so again, I have to maintain, you know, my business and my well-being. And so at the end of the day, that's my priority. So I do suffer from it, and I suffer severely from it. So yes, I do.
What are some of the ways that you've been reinforcing those boundaries with people when they bring it up? Or what are some of the ways that you've been protecting yourself from sort of like mass media communication about it?
Well, as far as mass media communication about it, I try to limit my exposure to the news, because I know that there's going to be some segment on there about it. And I do understand that for the media's target audience, the target audience may be interested in that. Okay. Or I don't know, maybe it's for ratings. Call me a cynic, you know. But at the end of the day, I just try to limit my exposure to media, in any form. Even if you're, for example, on Facebook, you might see something about it in an advertisement. It's like, oh my gosh. So I just try to limit my exposure that way. Also when it comes to people, the people that are near and dear to me, I'll just bluntly tell them, hey, listen, I don't want to talk about that. Or, you know, can we change topics? Or depending who the person is, I will tailor my approach to be mindful of how they might receive what I'm saying. So It's just, I'm not going to be nasty or ugly or anything like that. That's just not my personality. And that's not my technique. But when it comes to interacting with people at all, but just kind of saying, hey, let's talk about this or let's talk about that. And if it starts to creep in there, I'll just say, well, I'll try to change the subject. I will talk about something else. Or, you know, if the boundaries are not clear, then I try to make them as clear as possible and just say, listen, you know, as far as I'm concerned, you know, I'm there. I'm fatigued with COVID. I am fatigued with pandemic anything. So let's change the topic or let's go on to something else if we can. And I'd really appreciate it if we can. And most people really respect them. Most people really respect that. And so once I get it out there like that, but again, I just try to just be optimistic and talk about there are plenty of other things to talk about in the world besides the pandemic. So I try to gravitate towards that.
Yeah, there have been plenty of other things going on in the world kind of all the way through the last 2 years overlapping with the pandemic. What are some of those things that have been on your mind?
Oh, wow. Where to even start? You have foreign situations going on. You have the invasion of Ukraine by Russia. You have nuclear testing going on in North Korea. You have, I believe, some of the European countries trying to join NATO. You have, that's just foreign, overseas. You have, just here domestically, you have crime has started to increase. Cities like Chicago, cities like where I am, Memphis, you have crime increasing. That's just this year. So it could keep going. Crime is increasing. Inflation is on the rise. That's on the rise throughout the nation, and which is causing home prices to soar, which is, I think, further disadvantaging certain people. But the economy, I mean, inflation is going through the roof. Interest rate rises by the Federal Reserve. That's going on. You have incomes are kind of stagnant, whereas, of course, some wages are going up. However, others are not. So you have people graduating high school or, you know, getting entry level jobs with a starting salary or a starting wage that may be equivalent to what some people started a wage at 10 years ago. There's income inequality here domestically. You have, there was a shooting in Buffalo, New York, where 10 minorities were targeted because of their race. That's my understanding. You had that going on. And I watched the video. And when the gentleman got to a Caucasian man on the floor, he apologized to him, yet he shot a African-American woman in the head on the video. And to see him pull up and shoot people in cold blood, that was very, very emotional, knowing that as an African-American male myself, that that could have been me or someone I loved. And seeing that happen, people just going grocery shopping and not knowing that would be their last day on earth. Things like that going on. You have all kinds of racial inequality, racial injustices. You have, for example, George Floyd, and you have, Jordan Davis in Florida a long time ago. George Floyd. You have, there's so many of them. I can't name everyone, the racial injustices that are going on, the inequality that's going on. There's just crime. There's people living on the streets. There are people that are losing their homes that can't pay their bills. People having to make decisions. Well, hey, do I buy my medicine or do I buy some food for my children? or for myself. People having to make literal life or death decisions while people are on the news talking about, you know, multi-billionaires going to space. It's you have those types of situations going on here. You have, oh my gosh, there's just so many different competing topics that are on TV, that are in the media, that are going on in the world today. People, there's a political election around the corner, so we'll see the ads and we'll see the viciousness. There's a political candidate, I think, you know, Trump, that he's in certain people's crosshairs and people want to take him down or whatever. People are focusing on that. People want to know about his taxes. You know, people are, you know, still holding on to that. People are talking about Hillary and emails. People are talking about Bitcoin and cryptocurrencies and patriotism and, you know, Blue Lives Matter and all things like that. So, I mean, there's so much going on in the world today that, I mean, you can just throw something and hit it, and that it'll cause controversy. The Facebook groups on Facebook groups, people complaining about, you know, in their neighborhood about, you know, cars driving too slow or driving slow in the left lane, or, you know, this person, they made my sandwich wrong at Wendy's. So, I mean, literally, like, you name it, somebody's talking about it, you know, in Florida. The governor, Ron DeSantis, going at it with Disney. You know, you have that going on. You have same gender loving and rights of things of that nature. There was a leak at the Supreme Court about an opinion of Roe v. Wade. So, I mean, literally, you can just, there's plenty of other stuff to talk about. That stuff might be just as controversial, some of it maybe more, than the pandemic. But with that being said, there's lots of positive going on in the world too. So that's just not to say the negative. There's lots of positive things that are happening in the world as well. So, you know, there are lots of positive things that are going on, but unfortunately, it seems like maybe the negative gets a little bit more press than the positive, which is unfortunate. But again, you know, I'm not in the media business and I'm not a politician. So, I don't really, you know, have a vested interest in delivering one message or another to a particular audience. So,
Buffalo is really fresh. I'd like to ask gently how you decided to watch the video.
How or why?
We'll treat those as the same question. Well, yes, why?
Okay, well, why? I wanted to watch the video because I wanted to see for myself. And, of course, there are certain restrictions, be it governmental, local, whatever. But I wanted to see for myself what happened. I wanted to see. And that is why, online, of course, but it was, I just wanted to see, I'd heard about it and I'm like, what is this? You know, what's going on? And usually people, that are close to me, you know, they'll sometimes update me on things that are going on. And I said, what's going on? What is this Buffalo, New York? Because I had heard of a shooting in a subway earlier. And I thought that was the same one. And it's really sad. And it's really unfortunate where it's like, oh, I thought that was the same thing, but it wasn't. And so after watching it, it was just like, whoa, like, wait a minute, you know, and seeing that was just really, again, heartbreaking. But I wanted to see for myself what occurred. And I wanted to see for myself, of course, not breaking any laws or anything like that. That's not what I do. But I just wanted to see for myself what was their experience. And I saw it. And what was his experience from his viewpoint? And I saw that. Again, I just saw, but I can't go into anyone's mind or get into the operation of that. But just to give me more context with what I was hearing, ubiquitously, in the media. So
thank you so much for sharing that.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to ask how, it's going to take me a second to word this question.
Okay.
I'd love to hear something about how your work with grief has shaped your relationship to death over the last 2 years.
Oh, wow. How my work with grief has changed my relationship with death over the past 2 years. For me, it has been kind of a yo-yo effect, and I say this jokingly. I like to joke and I like to play, but it's really been kind of like a yo-yo effect, because some days it's like, okay, am I dying? Kind of like hypochondriac mode. It's like, is something wrong with me, or am I okay? Or when I eat something, I'm like, okay, is this going to bring me closer to death? At the same time, it has also opened up my eyes to things that I otherwise would not have been able to see or may have been insensitive to. So it has really, really opened up my eyes and given me a different outlook on, in particular, the dying process. I've learned a lot more about grief and what happens when people grieve, and realizing that grieving isn't just a state, but it's really a process, and it's non-linear. So there were misconceptions that I had about grieving and the grieving process that I learned and I educated myself on. And in doing that, I think it really opened up my eyes to be a lot more sensitive to others. One example being that I never realized that someone may be happy that someone is about to die or is actively dying. I never thought about that. That never entered my mind. I never thought about that. Like, why would someone be happy that someone is about to die or is on life support? Or, you know, why might they fake or feign sadness? Well, things we don't think about. Let's say, for example, that person may have been a victim of molestation by the dying, or that person may have been a victim of domestic violence, or they may have been in some way, shape, form, or fashion traumatized or abused by the dying. So naturally, someone may think that because a person is dying, that they should be sad, whereas a person that may have been a victim at the hands of the dying, they may not have that experience. And so it really opened up my eyes. That's just one example. But with me as an individual, it really has allowed me to have a newfound appreciation for relationships, for interactions with other people, for respecting other people, and having a real appreciation for life. It really has. It has made me a lot more optimistic. It has made me a lot more sensitive to the fact that we all have a limited amount of time here, irregardless of your education, irregardless of your money, irregardless of who you know. Those things might help you here on earth, but they certainly can't stop what the inevitable is. And we think, some people say, oh, well, hey, you die once and, you only get to live one. Well, excuse me. They say you die once, but you're living every day. Whereas people that may be grieving, they may think that they are suffering every day, which some people are. But at the end of the day, we all, last time I checked, unless we start getting into the medical and all that stuff, well, hey, I saw the light, or I blacked out, or your heart stopped, or defining death and things like that. I'm not an attorney. I'm not a doctor. So I'm not going to venture in their arena. But as far as I'm concerned, you know, we all have to leave here, and hey, we better make the most of it, because at the end of the day, we don't know, like those people that went grocery shopping in Buffalo. And again, I'll reference that again. They had no idea that they would wake up that morning and that would be the last morning that they woke up. They had no idea. So, you know, we could be just going to the store. I mean, just driving up the store, and that could be the last time we didn't have any idea. You know, you're just going to the store. I see different articles, and it's like, well, a gentleman was going to his friend's house, and all of a sudden, I think he ran off the road and wasn't wearing a seatbelt, and you know, came out of the vehicle, died. His mother was trying to search for him using Facebook and things of that nature, and it's like, you know, she's looking for him. Hey, son, if you can hear me, if you know I'm, if you know, just please respond. And I just find myself. And I don't know exactly what it is. I think it's some type of, I'm not going to say it's a bias, but for example, I don't know if you've had this experience, but hey, let's say you get a new car and you have a, I don't know, a Honda Accord. I'm just throwing it out there. A person, Jane or John Doe, gets a new Honda, and all of a sudden you notice all the other Hondas on the road, whereas before you did not notice them. And I don't know what psychological definition or what would describe that, but I know there's a name of it. I forgot the name of it, but it's just one of those things where now you're a lot more cognizant and you're a lot more aware of these things. Whereas before, this wasn't something I would have thought about. Like, huh? Like I didn't think about this. I didn't think about any of it. Like, what is this? Like, I didn't think about that. But now all of a sudden, you're a lot more aware of what's going on. And it's like there's a hypersensitivity to death and dying. So, yeah, that's, I think I may have rambled a little bit. So I hope I got your answer. So again, I'm just a lot more aware, just a little bit more hyper aware. And those stories kind of get my antenna. They get on my radar a little bit more. And so it's like, that's a story about somebody transitioning, or stories about grief, or dying or death. It's those things kind of pop on my radar a lot easier, and they bring to my attention a lot easier, whereas before I don't think they did.
I'd love it if you shared something about why you use the language of transitioning.
I use the language of, to be very honest, I'll be transparent, because of the fact that, number one, we're being recorded, and so I'm not sure who will listen to this, so I'm trying to be sensitive to that fact. But also, some people don't like the word death or dying. You know, that person was dying, that person is dying, or that person died, or that person, you know, I guess I use it kind of like a euphemism. Because it is a little bit more palatable. Now, as a doula, we are, well, some people say that we should use the word dying a lot more easily. However, I understand and I appreciate that. However, I must be sensitive to the needs of people. If someone is not ready to hear that word or is not ready to use that type of language, then I appreciate that. I would rather be a lot more cautious on the front end and then find out where a person is. And then from there, if they're open to using, hey, that person died, that has a lot more impact than using the word transitioning. So I'm mindful of the potential audience that I may encounter, not just in this recording, but also in the public. And I think just being understanding of that and being empathetic can help, because again, even though as a doula, as an end-of-life doula, I'm still a person and I'm still an individual, and you really don't want to turn off people, if you will, or all they talk about is death or dying and not meeting people where they are. So again, some people are not ready to hear dying, or they're dead, or they're just not ready for that. And I respect that and I appreciate that. So I may use the word transitioning or similar words to be respectful and sensitive to people.
Would you describe some of the services you provide as an end-of-life doula?
Sure. As an end-of-life doula, some of the services that I provide are advanced care planning, bereavement support, advocacy, assisting people with their legacy projects, assisting people with a legacy project or a life review, companionship, or caregiver respite, helping people implement their visual, and in certain cases, medical aid in dying. However, you know, again, helping people in those areas, and again, I make it explicitly clear in no uncertain terms, I'm not a therapist, I'm not a counselor, I'm not a social worker, I'm not a healthcare provider, I'm not a attorney, I'm not a financial advisor, I'm not a funeral director, I don't provide legal advice, I don't do any of that. So I am very mindful and respectful of those occupations, and I dare not come across as if I'm in that line of work. Not only could that open up potential litigation, but I certainly want to have respect for those persons that are in that capacity and not interfere or get in their profession. And I don't play one on TV.
Are there ways in which your services changed during the pandemic and because of the pandemic?
Most certainly. One of the major ways that it changed is when the pandemic occurred, access to clients was restricted because of the pandemic. So whereas a hospital, you could go and visit someone without reservation, now, and especially when the pandemic occurred, you're having to interact with someone virtually, or they can't have visitors, or they can't be seen, or they've had their visitation, they've met their visitation limit for the day. So it's like, but I need to be of service, and this person has me as a doula. So how do I interact? So, of course, there had to be changes, both contractually to capture the fact that, okay, before there was no pandemic, so I did not have to worry about liability when it came to potentially exposing someone, not saying that I did that or not saying that it didn't happen and it didn't occur. However, again, having to update paperwork and contracts and tempering expectations, whereas someone may have wanted you to be there physically in the room due to the pandemic, I can't, not because I don't want to, but because I can't. So I will do my best given the constraints that abound. I can do my best to be there, and I certainly will do just that. However, finding workarounds to support clients was, I think, one of the biggest changes that occurred utilizing technology. But then at the same time, I will say this. It was a positive element, because never for a minute did I think that I would be able to serve clients internationally, or help people internationally. So it's like, well, you know, that was a silver lining, where it's like, okay, well, you don't have to limit yourself to the people in your local metropolitan area. You can actually help people beyond borders. You can go beyond borders. So that was a silver lining.
Do you have much of a sense of how your clients find you?
How they fund me?
Find you.
Oh, fine. Well, online, from what I do, I am kind of a, I don't want to say a numbers nut, but I love data and I love metrics. And from what I've seen is primarily, it would be word of mouth. And second, place from that would be a doula directory, because when I usually ask people, because I want to track that to see, well, what's effective and what's not. I guess kind of using the, I forgot what it was, but it's something to the effect where, 70% of the results come from 30% of the people. And I forgot what that was. Most of it is word of mouth, and then directories. So that's what my data yields support.
What was it like establishing relationships with clients and patients online?
It was challenging because online, you, even via a phone call, you're missing that body language. You can't see the body language, and you don't know what people are thinking. Well, not that you know anything. I can't read minds. But you don't, it's like you don't have all the information. You don't know what they're kind of going through, because it's one of those things where, hey, you're walking down the street and someone says, hey, how's it going? And you say, oh, I'm fine. You're not really fine, or you may not really be fine, but it's one of the things where you say it and you just keep moving. And okay, a person can say something, but unless you're there sometimes, you may not be able to gauge, or, for example, maybe see a tear forming. You can see it maybe once it rolls down someone's face, but you really are unable to tell that physical sense. It can be challenging. And I really, again, I try to meet people where they are to see what type of energy they have and just really explore and take it from there. But again, it can be, and it has been, a little challenging because I'm more so used to interacting with people face to face. So it was a little challenging.
While respecting client confidentiality, is there something you can say about your own experiences of working with clients over the pandemic?
My own experiences in working with clients over the pandemic, while of course respecting client confidentiality, is that it varies. And I know that's common sense, but there's never been this. It's kind of like a snowflake, and you never get the same one, or the same experiences, or the same anything. There's no cookie cutter client. There's no template client. There's no, just one size fits all. Okay, I'm going to use a checklist, and I'm going to go bam, 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 and do this. No, it doesn't work that way. And, if someone expects that or wants that, might not be the right occupation, or the right calling, because there is no instruction guide, there is no book, there is no checklist that you can just knock them out and then go on to the next one. And if someone does that, with all due respect, I wouldn't want them to be my doula, because that's just not, that's not how I operate. But also, I think it has taught me is that, being authentic and being genuine goes a long way, because I think people can pick up on maybe phoniness or fakeness, and at least some people can. Not that I'm phony or fake, I'm not saying that, but what I'm saying is that people, they can tell when you're genuine. And at the end of the day, me myself, there have been incidences where I'll just tell someone, hey, given where we are, I certainly want you. And I tell everyone this, of course, respecting confidentiality, that listen, go out and see if there are other doulas that you may want to collaborate with, or you may want to serve you, because at the end of the day, this isn't just, you know, something that, oh, it's just fly by night. It means something to me. It's heartfelt. It is a calling. And I encourage people to, hey, you may want to talk to other doulas, or you may want to see, you know, what's a good fit for you. So, you know, it's not like a date or anything like that, but at the end of the day, you know, it's important for me. It's not about what I want, but it's important for me that a person is comfortable with me and that they've also had an opportunity to explore other doulas out there if they so desire. So, yeah, I hope I answered your question.
You did. And I want you to know that it's a premise of oral history that you can't do, like, you can do no wrong. Whatever you offer is this beautiful gift. So every question is answered correctly and interpreted correctly. There is no rambling. Except for me when I form a question. Did you have experience with clients pre-pandemic who were dying of something potentially infectious that you had to navigate?
Yes, I have. And when you say infectious, can you clarify method of transmission or mode of transmission? Because there are certain things that, for example, may be airborne, maybe bloodborne pathogens. Do you mind clarifying that, or could it be just anything?
Certainly. I really just mean anything that in your working with them could transmit to you. So whether that's something airborne, or if your work has a risk of blood contact, anything that might have you at risk and how you navigate those.
Yes. There have been incidences where that has been the case, and I use PPE, personal protective equipment. At the same time, I say this, I use PPE primarily. So I may use gloves or even like in the pandemic right now, you know, I use a N95 mask. So I'll use that. And whereas appropriate, I wear gloves, and I just let the clients know this isn't personal. This is just for our protection. It's kind of like when you call an 800 number, you know, this call is recorded for quality assurance, you know, we're going to verify the last four of your social for the protection of your account. You know, I worked in a bank, and, you know, we say things like that, and we're, you know, it's kind of like not a play on words, but we're protecting you by doing this. And so a person thinks, well, okay, it's not as invasive, or it kind of takes the edge off a little bit. So, of course, I let people know that, hey, this is for our protection. So for both of us, not just, it's not, oh, you have, you know, you have, goosebumps or something, and I'm, you know, the cooties, and I don't want to get them. You know, people don't, of course, even if they did have something transmissible, I think that it's still appropriate to be respectful and not to have them feeling as if they are, you know, like I felt when I, you know, if I sneeze out in public, you know, no one likes that feeling. So even if you have something transmissible, or if you don't, just treating people with respect all the way around. But yes, I personally use PPE. I try to protect myself. And again, it's just not about protecting myself, but also protecting others, because if I did come in contact with something, there's the potential for reinfection or transmission to other persons. And so I certainly don't want to do that as well. So again, just making sure everybody's safe, being all inclusive, that everybody's protected, and that, hey, I don't know, maybe I came in contact with something with somebody with COVID, and me using PPE will protect that other person. So I certainly want to be respectful of that and not transmit anything myself. So again, it goes both ways. I know you asked specifically about a potential client that may have something transmissible, but also I do protect. I just try to take precautions to protect every parties involved.
I'm curious, what does the word health mean to you?
Health, what does that mean to me? health, I guess. To me, it's, I guess, the status of your, forgive me, I'm not the most eloquent speaker, the status of your body, the status of your, like, if you had a little status symbol, like a battery status or something like that. It's just kind of, hey, what is your health? Your health is all-encompassing. It's mental. It's emotional. It's spiritual. It's physical. So maybe I just expanded my own definition by saying that. But I think health can mean a different variety of things. It is, I think, all-inclusive of your mental well-being, your physical well-being, your spiritual well-being, your emotional well-being. So I think the well-being of all those things, what is the status? Are you healthy emotionally? Are you healthy financially? I think the status of something, you know, the health, the, I don't know, Merriam-Webster might have a better definition than me, so I'm not sure if I'm the right person for that, but you asked me what I thought it was, so I tried to tell you.
What are some of the things you'd like for your own health?
For my own health, I would like to make sure that it's in tip-top shape. I want to make sure that I'm healthy. I could stand to lose a few pounds, but I just want to make sure that I'm healthy. I want to make sure that, hey, I'm in the right place mentally, that I can make competent and sound decisions. I want to make sure that my mental health as well. Hey, you know, am I, you know, is there something going on with me physically? Do I need to get an EKG? Do I need a CAT scan? Do you know what's going on so I can stay in the best possible shape so I don't burden others with my own health? Spiritually, you know, am I healthy spiritually? Am I where I think I should be? Am I healthy financially, you know, especially given the current state of the country and everything going on? So I just want to be as best as possible, given the conditions around me, just taking precautions to remain here for a little while longer. So, and making sure that I tried to do what I could and that I did my part to try to stay here a little bit longer and not engage in maybe activity that might shorten up on you.
How do you think we could get to how do you think we get to a system where that kind of health would be easily available to you?
Oh gosh. I personally think there's this question is really like an onion, and I think there's so many layers. You know, I'd probably still be talking about this like a week later. I really think that, well, I guess I'll seek clarification from you. When you use the word we, do you mean Americans? Do you mean humans? Do you mean adult? Do you mean, I guess, because that would kind of drive the answer.
I'm going to bounce it back to you. Pick a we.
Okay, you're good. Let me use, I guess, for simple purposes, maybe the people on Earth. You know, I think that maybe knowledge, understanding, empathy. I think that some of those could be a great start. Knowledge, understanding, and empathy.
Would you share an example of a moment where you received empathy over the last couple of years?
Sure. The moment when I received empathy, I was in a seminar, and we actually had to role play, and while albeit simulated, you know, I thought that the person with whom I was role playing with did a really good job of empathy and active listening. So I guess that was a scenario when we were doing some, like I said, some role playing, and we the other individual, I believe an aspiring doula, was very, very empathetic and, you know, demonstrated some of those characteristics. And I was like, I was really impressed. If I'm talking about it now, you know, that person must have been really good. And they did a fantastic job. So I think that was an experience.
Can you pinpoint any of the ways that you learned to practice empathy?
Sure. One way is active listening. All too often we are thinking about what we're going to say next, as I'm doing here, but really taking time out to actively listen and to clear your mind, because all day, every day, our minds are racing. And, you know, we've really got to, if we so desire, excuse me, I'm not yawning at the interview, please. That's not what I'm doing. Practicing empathy by listening, by removing ourselves. One of the things that I do, and I will say this, just a little secret, if you will, I try to remove I, me, my, you know, and because it's not about me, I try to remove I, me, my, and focus on you, yours, and your, because that helps, because it's not about me at the end of the day. So if you want to empathize with someone and put yourself in someone else's shoes, you have to put yourself in their shoes, which does not involve wearing your own. So you need to forget about yourself and focus on them. So just a few. Okay.
What are some of the emotions you've experienced from clients who are on a path to transitioning?
Some of the emotions that I've experienced, to be perfectly honest, when I'm there, when I'm with them, I remain typically... what's the word? I typically remain open and available. I'm not really sure those would be classified as emotions. However, in the privacy of my own dwelling, I felt a range of emotions, from sadness to, oh boy, sadness to despair, hopeless, because me, I, as a doula, end-of-life doula, not birthing doula, just to clarify, I don't show those emotions with the client, because someone has to remain, you know, relatively strong. And that's what I do. However, again, I'm still a human, and I'm a son. I am a brother. I am an uncle. I am a grandson. I'm those things. And so just like a client may be a daughter, a son, is different things to different people. They are different things to different people. So am I. And I can't help but to think about if and when, if I don't transition before someone else, but when I will have a similar experience as one of my clients. There was an incident where a person passed away, and a child passed away. A client's child passed away, and I was there at the service, the funeral service, and it was very hard for me seeing a mother and a father walk past the casket with their son in it. And that was probably the one singular incident that I almost lost it. And it was very heartbreaking to see that in particular, because it resonated with me, because again, I am a son myself and I have a mother and a father and they're still living. And to see what it's like if I were to die or if I were to transition, what they could potentially go through, it was just heartbreaking. So that, yeah. But normally I like to think I'm pretty level, not stoned or not stoned. Okay. Let me be very clear, not stone faced or just stonewalled, but I'm certainly not stoned when I serve clients. I don't engage in that type of behavior. So in that at all, but not judging those who do, that's your business, but I'm just not emotionless. I'm there with the person. However, I also have to remember that I have to remain clear-headed, and I can't let my emotions take over, because I would just want to hug everyone and just, you know, say it's going to be okay. And emotions can just have, you know, I need to respect the doula code of ethics and all of those things. And so, but again, yeah, that's that. So yeah, that's all.
What are some of the reactions you've observed in your clients as they are dying?
Well, some of the reactions, they can range from guilt. They can range guilt to some people are thankful. Some people are dismayed. Some people are anxious. Some people have been, they felt, nervous, rejected, weak, mad, furious. So literally all a range of emotions. There have been fearful, you know, some people have been happy because they know that they have their certain beliefs. And so again, depending on their religious belief and who I'm working with, the emotions are infinite. So I have experienced a wide range of them.
Did you see any changes in emotional reactions from people grieving and dying in the last 2 years in contrast to what you had seen before?
I have. Pre-pandemic, I think now during the pandemic, it's hitting people, certain people, a little bit harder, especially for those people that are having to transition or die alone. People that are in hospitals alone that do not have physical access to their families, friends, or loved ones. They can't touch their hand. They can't hold them. They cannot. They can't see them close. They can't feel their warm hands touching theirs. They cannot hug them. They cannot embrace them. And so I really think that has hit some people really hard. I really think it has hit some people really hard, because it's bad enough that someone is losing a loved one, but if they're in the hospital and they can't come and see them, or they can't come and hold them or touch them, that, in my experience, has been one of the toughest parts in this pandemic, the post-pandemic, in this post-pandemic world. I think it has been one of the most, it has been one of the toughest things that people have had to go through. Whereas post-pandemic, you can be around your loved one. There are no restrictions. You don't have to worry about any shots or anything like that. They weren't worried about those things. Whereas now, you do have to worry about those. And it's sad, because having to see people and their loved ones, and there's nothing I can do. There's nothing that they can do. There's nothing that anyone can do, because people have their policies. They have their regulations, they have their procedures, they have their protocol. And so that's really heartbreaking to see that. Whereas, again, before the pandemic, that was a non-factor. So that, in my observation, that has been a barrier.
Has your relationship to touch changed over the last couple of years?
Has my relationship to death changed?
Touch. Although death is, I'll also listen to the word death.
Okay. Has my relationship to touch changed? It has somewhat, but not a lot. I'm not really a, I'm going to leave that out of here. I'm not a toucher or a hugger. I will if I know you or something like that. But if you're my immediate family, then I'm very touchy-touchy, feely-feely, huggy-huggy. If you're not my immediate family, then, okay, what's going on here? What's going on now? What are we doing? what's going on here now? Like, you know, I want to know because we're touching what's going on. Again, you know, it's just, maybe it's a paranoia or anything like that or something like that, but it's just kind of one of those things. Okay. Well, we should keep our hands to ourselves. That's what I was always taught as a kid. You just keep your hands to yourself. And so, you know, we don't have any misunderstandings. We don't have any misgivings. We don't have anything like that. So we just keep our hands to ourselves. And so I respect that. You know, I can appreciate people that want to hug everyone and give the world their hug and their love. As far as I'm concerned, you know, okay, I appreciate that. I'm just kind of like, okay, we can keep our hands to ourselves, you know. And this was pre-pandemic, so it's not like it just occurred.
And now I'm going to ask your question. Has your relationship to death changed over the course of the pandemic?
Man, I've got to stop inadvertently giving questions. It has. It's, again, it's just something being more aware of, more cognizant of, and just something to just being a lot more open-minded, you know. Just sometimes I find myself thinking about, that would be good at my funeral. You know, it'd be like, that's a good idea. Like, how can I implement that in, you know, so I find little ways and I notice little things. I'll see, like, for example, I may see a gray hair or something popping up where I'm like, man, you know, I'm getting old here. Like, you know, I'm getting closer to the end. Like, it's really happening. Like, you know, and I think, well, not necessarily. I just think, how? Like, how's this going to go down? How's this going to happen? So I think about those things.
Were you able to maintain kind of social connections that mattered to you throughout the pandemic?
Yes, I have. There has been no change in that. You know, I've most of my life, when I left college, after I graduated college, I've always been kind of, my family and my friends have always been spread out. So we've always had to communicate, in one shape or form. We've always had to kind of communicate the way we communicate now. So this is no change. I don't know how many minutes I put on my phone or anything like that, but it's like, yeah, we stay in touch, but again, there's been no change there. That's just been business as usual.
What does the word safety mean to you?
Safety? Safety, yes. The word to me, the word safety means, let me come up with something that's safety. I guess to me it means safety means to me not being in harm's way or not being subject to hurt or harm or danger or not subject to those things.
thinking in the really narrow confines of COVID precautions, what are some of the things that you changed to feel safer?
Well, wearing gloves and wearing masks, for example, if I go out to eat and I go, I just went yesterday to a restaurant where it was kind of self-serve. So I don't touch the tongs. I will either use gloves or I will use a napkin or a paper towel. Or if I do touch them, I touch them first and then I wash my hands and eat to help prevent cross-contamination. So I don't want to, I want to minimize cross exposure to things like that. So just doing that and usually wearing masks. I'm not and just wearing masks and I mean, socially distancing, you know, you can try that, but someone's going to, I mean, you're in the supermarket and you're like, can you, you know, I don't want to get out of character and just say, can you, sir, ma'am, can you please give me 6 feet or something? You know, people, personal space just isn't a concept to some people. But again, you know, I don't want to go to, you know, I don't want to like ruin my career reputation or over it, you know, or anything like that. Not saying I would, but it's like, you don't know that, like, ma'am, we're in the aisle to check out and you're next to me and you're in front of your basket or your buggy. Can you go behind your buggy and put the front of your buggy next to me so we can have some distance? And so, you know, again, I just try to change my behavior and just try to, you know, take those little steps to try to mitigate risk, if you will, and to increase safety.
How are you feeling about the immediate future?
The immediate future. I'm cautiously optimistic. That's all.
What are some of your hopes for a longer term future?
I hope for world peace. I hope for equality. I hope for equity. I hope for justice. I hope for diversity. I hope for inclusion. I hope for accessibility. I hope for all of those things and so much more.
What are some of the ways that you've been taking care of yourself during the pandemic?
By trying to do some of the things that I was doing pre-pandemic, trying to spend time with friends and trying to spend time with family and loved ones and really appreciating them and trying to spend as much time as I can with them. So when I can, so, but just really valuing them, appreciating them and just trying to prioritize self-care. Sometimes there are competing priorities, but trying to prioritize self-care.
I'm coming to the end of my questions, and my last ones are a bit odd.
Sure.
I'd like to start by asking, what do you wish Americans knew more about in history? So thinking of Americans right now, what do you wish Americans knew more about?
I personally wish more Americans knew about African-American history. You can call me biased if you'd like. But I really wish that there was more emphasis placed on that. And I say that with hesitation because depending on who's telling the story is going to be how the story is going to be told. So again, that's what I would wish. So I wish that there was more emphasis on African-American history and in particular, some of the accomplishments of African-Americans because, you know, I don't know if you know this, but it seemed to me that, for example, when Will Smith slapped Chris Rock, you know, that resonated more than I'm sure then I can't think of an accomplishment off the top of my head, but I'm pretty certain that there were African-American kids that possibly graduated with scholarships and got accepted into colleges and things of that nature. But that act of violence was, we heard more about it than some of the positive things that African-Americans do and have done. So I just think that I would hope that African-American history, so in some of the advancements and some of the accomplishments of some of African-Americans. And so having it be an equal playing field. So, you know, if we spend, let's say, 20 hours talking about European history, why not spend 20 hours talking about African history? So we know about the Nina, the Pinta, the Santa Maria, but what about the, what about where Kunta Kinte was? And gosh, I forgot. I was in Gambia last year, and I forgot what tribe he was from. It's slipping me. It's been a long day. But why don't we hear about those types of things and things like that? So again, that's just my thing.
What was it like traveling during the pandemic?
It was. It was tiring. Because I traveled to Africa, to Gambia and Senegal, and heavens, oh my gosh, it was a headache and it was a pain. COVID test 72 hours before departure. It's easy here in the U.S., relatively, provided you can get an appointment somewhere. But in Africa, it's not so easy. I had to spend a day to go to a bank and pay the 50 US dollar, or in Gambia, the whatever the equivalent is for a dalasi. I had to take a taxi. I had to go there. It was hot. I had to stand in line. I had to get a receipt, and then I had to pay the fee, and then I had to, that took a whole day. And then the next day I had to actually go and take a taxi and go to the stadium to go get tested. And that was day two. And then I actually had to wait, and I had to, go somewhere where there was internet or Wi-Fi or something to access the results so I could even leave the country, because if I didn't, then they wouldn't allow me on the plane. So it was a pain and it was extremely nerve-wracking. And so I said, I certainly would not do anything like that now. Everything would need to just go away. But it was frustrating. It was nerve-wracking. It was costly. And so it just made me not want to travel during the pandemic like that again. So I certainly won't be going back to Africa anytime soon or overseas, anywhere leaving North America. Probably I won't be going, because there's just too many.
What do you think scholars in the social sciences and the humanities, so fields like literature and poli-sci and sociology, what should we be studying right now to help us understand this moment that we're living through?
Wow. Wow, to understand it. I really think that this is a fantastic start. I think it's really a fantastic start. I think just connecting with people, what you're doing is, and the project that you're a part of, I think it's phenomenal. And I think you all are doing a great job at this by contacting people and getting their experiences. In this instance, hopefully, I don't think it will ever happen, but, you know, I don't think I'll ever run for political office. So if the file was obtained or, you know, by whoever, and maybe re-edit it or anything like that to make it say something that I didn't say, that's not on my mind right now. But I think that talking to people one-on-one, gaining their trust, in being able to talk to them and see how they feel. While at the same time, I also think going across different demographics. I don't know how the project is segmenting demographics. I don't know if they're going to underserved communities. Hopefully that is tapped into, because there are people, the experiences of, let's say, a person in underserved, impoverished community, let's say in, you know, I'm in Tennessee, and let's say in Mississippi, you know, a community that is where, you know, 25% of the people are at or below the poverty line, seeing how their experiences are, people of different ages, of different races, of different socioeconomic classes, seeing how talking to them and gaining their experiences, because in my own experience, I think that sometimes that people can maybe be underrepresented. And as I've seen in certain instances, not in this or anything like this, but sometimes, you know, people are asked questions or they're spoken to and they may not understand what they're saying, or they may attribute certain words or questions a certain way, and the response might not be, well, I mean, and I appreciate your open-endedness. There is no right or wrong response. You know, I appreciate that. But I just think that talking to people of different socioeconomic classes, talking to people in different income brackets, talking to people in different parts of the country. There's a difference between of different political classes. I'm sure there's a difference from a Democrat in California from a Democrat in Mississippi. I'm sure there are some commonalities there, and I'm sure that there are some differences there too. And identifying how they feel and what their experience is, because again, everyone's going to have a different experience. So hopefully going across different ages, races, genders, I mean, you don't want to pick up the phone, hey, or, you know, what's your blank, blank, blank? And, you know, well, what's going on? You know, well, we're seeking, you know, a certain demographic. But I just think talking to different people, different places, different walks of life, I think that you all could, there's a wealth of information there. So just a treasure trove.
I'd like you to imagine speaking to a historian in the future, someone far enough in the future that they have no lived experience of this moment. What would you tell them cannot be forgotten about this moment? What, like, gap can they not allow to happen in the telling of this history?
I would tell them, I'd say, don't forget about the people that may not have had a voice or whose voices may not have been able to be heard. While there may be a consensus on certain things, there are people that are, you know, forgotten or feel forgotten about. And because a person or persons may feel forgotten about, that doesn't mean that they didn't have an experience too, or that didn't mean that they didn't have feelings or thoughts or emotions. And I would just say, don't forget about people that may not have the influence or the access to be able to share their feelings, their thoughts, their emotions. Don't forget about the trauma, the mental trauma that some people went through during this pandemic, because for some of these people, it was hell. People who are extroverts that need people, that need to be, that gain energy from being around people, for them it was hell. And I think don't forget about them, although I'm not one. I would say don't forget about the mental impact or the impact emotionally that this pandemic or that this time period had on people, because a lot of people suffer in silence and they carry a smile with them, but don't forget about it. And also, if you can, I don't know whose department it would fall up under, but don't be surprised if there are effects from people's mental and emotional well-being that may be far felt in the future, or that may be far reaching. So it's kind of like thinking about, well, when people say, for example, I hear people say, well, yeah, we need to go back to the good old days. Well, you've got to remember, you've got to bring some context there. If you want to do that, let's think about who they were good for, and let's think about who they were not good for. Because for you and for me, the pandemic, not you as a person, but for me, the pandemic, it's, you know, I appreciate being able to work remotely sometimes. It takes off, and sometimes it's like, well, we don't have to meet face-to-face. I can appreciate that. But sometimes it's like, I don't want to ignore, and I don't want to forget about those people who are going through mental and emotional distress right now, because they can't get to go into the office. They can't get to interact with somebody. And I can't forget about that. And don't forget about those people. Don't forget about them. And if you can, try to pinpoint what may be occurring at the point in time in the future, and see what effects or what was the precipitate to cause that to happen that may have come from the pandemic. It may sound really confusing, and I'm probably confusing you, so I do apologize, but it's just like, you know, let's, before we just say, oh, these people are crazy. No. Some people look at the TV show Hoarders and they're like, oh, those people are crazy. I don't believe that. I said that too once when I was ignorant. You know, you look at a TV, shock value. Oh, those people are just crazy. No, no, no. Something happened, or some things happened that got them to that point. I'm not a clinical psychologist or a therapist or a psychotherapist. I'm not any of those things, but something happened to those people that are in that situation, and let's not neglect that. So if there are people that are suffering from effects in the future, see what, not to cause blame or not to pinpoint, but see if maybe the pandemic may have been a result of that, and maybe try to learn from it to hopefully mitigate a future potential pandemic's effects, so that less people may go through what others may be experiencing at that point in time in the future.
I want to thank you so much for the generosity of your time and the thoughtfulness of your answers. Those are all of the questions I know how to ask at this moment, but I'd like to open up some space. If there's anything you want to say that I haven't made room for, please say so.
Well, I just want to thank you for your time, for your willingness to listen for about an hour and 48 minutes, of which I have probably talked for a good hour and 40 of it. So thank you for your patience. Thank you for your endurance. Thank you for what you're doing. And hopefully this maybe is maybe a drop that wears away at the rocks somewhere. Hopefully someone, some entity, may find it helpful, hopefully. And I hope that you continue doing the work that you're doing, and that not only are you, but the establishment with whom you're associated with, go on and go forth to do great things.
Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.